Hi, this is Newt. Due to the virus, I'm recording from home, so you may notice a difference in audio quality. On this episode of Newt's World, I am really excited to have Rob Smith as my guest to talk about really a wide range of things. Rob is a very unusual person. In fact, I think it's fair to say that he moves to his own drummer and does so in a way that I find very compelling. He's just got a brand new book out, which I recommend very highly, Always a Soldier. He also has really remarkable background in that he is a Republican, black, and gay. So if you can imagine the conversations that he has, they're fascinating. And I've watched him in action, and he is very calm and very cool about what he believes, very open to you agreeing or disagreeing, and very interested in dialogue. So I think you'll find getting to know Rob Smith is a terrific thing, and he is going to be part of our Gingrich 360 umbrella group, and he's launching his own podcast with iHeartMedia, which is entitled, you'll understand why in just a minute, Rob Smith is Problematic, which will start late next month. Rob, it's terrific fun to have you on board, but let me just give you the widest possible opening to start with. Why are you problematic?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for that introduction. I mean, I got a lot to live up to there, Newt. So why am I problematic? The definition of problematic is presenting a problem or a difficulty. And my existence, as you said before, I'm black, I'm gay, and I'm a Republican, and proud of that fact. And I present a difficulty to lots of people on the left and the right, but particularly the left, because they are stuck in this mode where they try to define people that are like me via our alleged victimhoods, right? And I'm not a victim, and I don't subscribe to all of the things that they expect me to subscribe to just because I'm both black and gay. And in fact, there are more conservative and Republican principles that are more aligned with the way that I live my life. And those principles are loving America. Those principles are self-reliance. Those principles are so much deeper. And I'm problematic to the left because I have branched out and I said that I do not allow them to define me. I define myself. And how I define myself right now is as a Republican.
Why is that true? Why don't you define yourself as an independent? Maybe less conflict ridden.
There'd be less conflict, but I'm a provocative person, Newt. So number one, I like conflict. I did this to provoke and I did this to incite conflict. And I don't like independence because, first of all, the biggest leftists you'll ever meet in your life will call themselves independents. And they're not independents, they're leftists. And I don't like sitting on the fence. I like having a bold way that I see the world and a bold way that I share my thoughts about how I see the world. And I'm not here to sit on a fence. I'm not here to play it safe. I'm not here to be comfortable or make people comfortable. So that's why I decided not to be an independent. I feel like I don't know that there are any true independents. I think that people claim that they're independents because they don't really want to rock the boat. And I'm not just trying to rock the boat. I'm trying to push it over.
When you're at a bar or you're somewhere with people, and you tell them that you're black and conservative and gay, what sort of reaction, a hostile reaction, a let's have another drink reaction? That's a fair amount for them to absorb.
Me being black, gay, and Republican is not something I lead with when I'm meeting people for the first time. I like to start off with things that bring us together, and lots of the things that I've just described myself as is something that divides people. I think that it becomes more interesting to people once they get to know me. My politics are interesting, but then again, we do politics all day, every day, and we don't necessarily want to do it at the bar. But I'll tell you that the response that I get from people that come across me on social media or that have read my stuff or see my stuff is this sense that this is not supposed to be. because if this is real, then this causes me to question every single thing that I've ever been told by both Democrats and Republicans about people that are in these particular identities that are immutable characteristics of mine. The response runs the gamut. It's anything from quizzical surprise, shock, to outright anger. Since I started doing this, and you know, the subtitle of the book is Coming Out as America's Favorite Black Gay Republican, and I came out, quote unquote, as conservative 2 years ago. And the reaction from some people on the tolerant and inclusive left is vicious. They are angry that I don't define myself in the way that they feel comfortable defining me. They feel angry about the fact that, well, how could you support these policies or this administration because these people hate you, or in the words of Joe Biden, they want to put you back in chains. And Newt, you and I both know that neither one of those things is true. So people respond with a lot of anger to something that they've never been exposed to before, something that they don't quite understand. And I've gotten this anger from both the hard left and the hard right. But when you bring it back into the fact that you said, why don't I identify as independent? I do believe that there are a couple of people out there that do identify as independent. And I think that they are empowered by somebody that is not defining their politics and how they see the world based off of these immutable characteristics.
Which was more challenging for you, revealing that you were gay or that you're Black conservative?
So coming out as gay, and I came out at 19 years old to my mother, who did not take it well. I talk about that in the book, Always a Soldier. And that was an emotionally devastating moment. I talk about having suicidal ideations and going through all of that stuff. So that was difficult. But it was not the disruptive moment in my life that coming out as conservative was. Now, when I came out as conservative a couple of years ago, I did it in a very public way. There was a feature on me in the Daily Mail. Then the Fox News producers got a hold of me. I came out on Jesse Waters' show, and it was kind of off to the races. And that was a very disruptive moment in my life. You have to realize I was living in New York City. I was a gay New York City liberal, had all the friends doing all the things that New York City liberals do. And when I started to become a more prominent, visible, vocal figure, not only as a Republican, but as somebody who unabashedly supports the president and will never be ashamed of supporting the president now or ever, that was too much for people to handle. And so then I started losing friends. My professional career became in jeopardy. I have a degree in journalism from Columbia University. I was working in the journalism field. I produced, I was writing, I was doing all of those things. And so now who I was politically didn't jibe with the job I was doing. So then there was professional insecurity as well. I'm married. There were friends that were our friends that decided not to be my friend anymore. There were people that are at my wedding that now pretend as if I don't exist. There were people that decided to stop being my husband's friend because of me. So coming out as a conservative Republican was a massively disruptive event in my life. That's the reason why I decided to talk about that aspect of it in my book. And I get so many messages, DMs, Facebook messages, emails from people, Newt, that are terrified to come out as conservatives or Republicans or Trump supporters or whatever you want to call it in this day and age. They are terrified that they will lose their friends. They are terrified that they will lose their family. They are terrified that they will be fired from their jobs. I've gone through most of that stuff. Coming out as Republican was more disruptive.
You must have had some sympathy then for Barry Weiss's letter to the publisher of the New York Times and her explanation of the level of hostility that she was getting just for having independent thoughts. Now, not being pro-Trump, and she was still a good liberal. She's punching a lot of the right buttons, but somehow she wasn't marching in step exactly as she was supposed to. So you must have had some identity with that and thinking that sort of validated the gap between the Columbia Journalism School and the reality of the modern newsroom.
The things that she said in her letter were so spot on, and it was so what lots of people had experienced, even people who are liberal and not even necessarily conservative leaning. if they're not the right kind of liberal in these spaces, then they're excommunicated. If you question any liberal orthodoxy, you are excommunicated. This is the major problem with the mainstream media right now and the institutions like Columbia University that I am intimately aware of that sort of push out these people to not be journalists, to not be independent, curious, free thinkers, but to be activists in a certain way for the liberal agenda or the Democrat agenda or whatever it is that you want to call it. It was an iconic moment, her resigning in that way. And there's so much of what was in that letter that anybody and people on the right, left, whatever, if they stray out of a certain kind of orthodoxy, they will be punished for it. But this happens so much more vociferously on the left. That's what happened to me. It's what happened with Bari. It's what happens to so many people who don't push the prevailing liberal orthodoxy. And like I said, that's why I decided to come out as a conservative Republican. That is why I'm so provocative in the things that I say, not only in this book, Always a Soldier, but in that upcoming podcast and all of the stuff that I do. Because this is the time in American history, Newt, where we have to break down these ideas that just because of identities, just because of immutable characteristics, people have to think, act, behave in certain ways. And if we don't break this stuff down now and get to the business of being Americans and figuring out what our identity is as Americans, then we're not going to make it because these leftists and these socialists and these Marxists are going to destroy it. And this undying emphasis on identity is the way that they're going to do it.
I think that's right. I think a great deal of the fight we're now seeing is an effort to divide us and is actually just a replay of all of the lessons for radicals that are very clear, that are actually trained to. The people who run Black Lives Matter actually hold courses on how to organize the fight in such a way that you maximize hostility and that you do everything you can to make your opponent 100% evil. You've lived in some ways a remarkably complex life. I mean, I want to go back to one of your early key decisions. What made you decide to join the U.S. Army?
I'm from West Akron, Ohio. This is a city in Ohio. We're about 98.6% Black, I believe. I come from a single-parent household. There wasn't a whole lot of money floating around. Now, I never lie and say that I'm from the projects or I lived some hard scrabble. It was nothing like that. But we'll just say in the high schools that I went to, there wasn't a lot of space for somebody like me. I was always a high-achieving student. I was always relatively intelligent, but they kind of didn't know what to do with me because I wasn't dribbling a basketball or throwing a football, right? So I graduated at 16 years old. I was still living at home. Obviously, I was 17 years old. I was waiting tables at Denny's. I just got the sense that there was just nothing there and that there was just nothing going on. I decided to go up and call the recruiters for the Army. And I just said, I need to do this because I need to do something with my life. I just knew that there was nothing in Akron, Ohio. And this is a funny story. I get into it in the book. So I meet the recruiter. And obviously, I'm a gay teenager. I didn't really know that I was defining it as gay at the time. I just knew that I had an attraction to men. So this recruiter comes to my door and I had a massive crush on this recruiter. He could have told me anything. And what he told me was that the best thing to do in the Army was the Army infantry. He said it would be fun. He said it would be all this stuff. And I'm like, sign me up. Let me go do it. I'll go in. I'll serve for a couple of years. I'll get out. I'll go to college. Little did I know that 9/11 was going to happen. I was going to end up deploying to Iraq and all this other stuff. I didn't know any of that stuff. I get into the Army, and this is the Army Infantry Boot Camp Basic Training. That is the toughest job you will do in the Army. And it broke me down physically and mentally and emotionally, but it also built me back up into a person that I think is kind of indestructible.
So you joined the Army. Did you go home and tell your mom?
Well, she had to know because she had to sign the paperwork for me to enter the military because I was so young. I wasn't 18. Mind you, I was 17.
So you end up in the Army. My dad spent 27 years in the infantry. I grew up as an Army brat. What would you say was the biggest lesson you learned that you would not have learned if you had not joined the Army?
So this is what I think, Newt. It always comes down to discipline. the military, not only basic training, but my 5 years in the Army infantry in general, including the deployments to Kuwait, deployments to Iraq, the whole thing, it taught me a level of discipline that I still use. I use discipline in my day-to-day life every single day. If it's discipline in going to the gym, if it's discipline with my eating, if it's discipline with my time, because I have a lot of things that need to happen. It taught me discipline. And when I got out into the civilian world after the military, it shocked me, and it will never cease to shock me, the lack of discipline that most people living their day-to-day lives just have. There's no discipline. That's why we have obesity rates. That's why we have just laziness. That's why we have so many problems. And I think in society can be boiled down to just a lack of personal discipline. And that is the most important thing that I was taught, not only in basic training, but in my 5 years in the Army itself. And it is the one thing that I use every single day. And I've been out of the military for quite some time now, and I use the discipline that it taught me every single day.
And where were you sent to?
My duty station was Fort Carson, Colorado. I was deployed to Kuwait in a training mission. My deployment in Kuwait happened right after 9/11. So I did a training mission in Kuwait. It was about 8 or 9 months. And then a year after that, I deployed to Iraq 3 weeks after the initial invasion. And I was in Iraq just short of a year.
Talk first about Kuwait. What was it like being a Black American in an Arab country?
When you are Black and you go to other countries, you're just seen as American, right? So when I was in Kuwait, they just saw me and my other soldiers. We were American soldiers. We were Black, white, Latino. We spread the gamut. So when people saw us with that uniform on, mind you, because I'm in my uniform all the time, it was safe enough at that time to venture out of the base. Kuwait's a very, very friendly place to Americans, very friendly. So we would go out into the city, we would go look at other things, we would go into the markets and things like that. So you're seen as American. So it's not that people saw me as Black or anything like that. They saw that uniform and they saw an American. And I talk about that in the book as well. I think I talk about the fact that when you are Black in America, you are so often seen or defined by other people as Black that when I went to Kuwait, I think I was about 20. It was a quite a different experience being seen as American. And it was the same when I went to Iraq. And I think that honestly, that's when I really started seeing myself as American. And all of those barriers that people want to put up between us, whether those barriers are race or ethnicity or sexual orientation or religion or whatever, all of those barriers were broken down. And I got the privilege to see myself as an American.
Where were you stationed in Iraq?
We flew into Kuwait and we convoyed through Kuwait into Iraq. So I went through Baghdad, I went through Samarra, I went all the way up. And where we ended up staying was a town called Al-Riyad, which was about 45 minutes south of Kirkuk, which was where the big base was. We made our home in bombed out buildings. I slept on the ground. We found this abandoned grain factory, which was this enormous amount of space. And we kind of took over these bombed out buildings and we made them our home and we kind of set up there.
That must have been a pretty amazing experience.
It was amazing. It was intense. I look back on it and I did see combat in Iraq. I saw combat a couple of times, but it's funny because I think about the discipline that the military gave me every single day, and obviously I use that to help me negotiate my day-to-day life. But as I've been doing the rounds for this book, it has started making me think more and more about the time that I spent in Kuwait and the time that I spent to Iraq. And these feelings that are coming up right now are oddly nostalgic for a place where I almost got my head blown off 3 times. It was a very intense experience, and also you're so young. You are fearless at that age, but looking back on it, it was transformational. And I can just look back to that 20-year-old that didn't know anything, and I can just look back to it and say, I protected my brothers in arms and I was in an all-male unit. And I'm proud of it. I have mixed feelings about the Iraq war itself, but I'm proud of my service.
And I think that's the way it should be. You were doing your duty. There's a general ground rule. I'm curious to get your reaction. That what really makes units effective, even more than love of country and all that, is the bonding with the person next to you. The fact you don't want to let them down, where the cohesion is inside the unit. They do become a family. Does that fit your experience?
No, that's absolutely true. You're going to love these guys most of the time. You're going to hate them a lot of the times, and you're going to disagree. A lot of the times that I did see combat in Iraq was because of poor leadership in the squad level. And that's complicated because a lot of people like to think of all soldiers as selfless heroes that always make the right decisions. And one of the things that I wanted to really get across in this book is that a lot of the soldiers that you see, and these are young guys, they're just trying to make it from one day to the next. But your unit is more cohesive when you do have that family unit, because you have a lot of love for these people. And some of the soldiers that I served with, we're still in contact via Facebook and we still talk. And I know that some of them have had issues with substance abuse, with PTSD, with all that other stuff. And that's the price that you pay from it. But I love these guys forever. And one of the things to me, and I talk about sort of being gay in the unit and in those days having to be closeted because of the don't ask, don't tell rule. And my biggest regret was, I think that the fact that I wasn't able to be kind of open about that part of my life is what kept us from not being as close and strong as we could have been. Because when you're keeping a secret from somebody and you are closing off a part of yourself, and I think that that is one of my biggest regrets. And that's why I became such an advocate for ending that rule. And we were successful in ending that rule. And thank God we did. And I'm so glad that some of these gay and lesbian soldiers today can have the experience that I never got to have, where they can be their full selves in their unit and help strengthen unit cohesion in that way.
From that standpoint, because you had such a sense of country coming out of all this, and being an American, what is your reaction when you see people tearing down statues?
My reaction is, these statues are being torn down out of ignorance. I did a segment on Fox News and I was doing my research before I did it. And there were statues that were being torn down of people that died fighting slavery, people that were known for being abolitionists. And there is a lack of historical knowledge that comes with that anger that the mob has when they tear down some of these monuments. And then some of the other figures, there's a real national conversation that needs to be had about the significance of some of those people, but tearing them down is not the answer. And I think that President Trump's idea of creating more monuments so that we can celebrate the totality of what everybody has brought to the building of this country is such a great idea. And you have people like Jackie Robinson and Harriet Tubman, and I believe that Booker T. Washington is going to be in that. So instead of tearing down, we need to add to the conversation. But of course, when you add to the conversation, that engenders a love for these great Americans. And I think that the anger from a lot of these mobs comes from the fact that they have been taught and manipulated to hate the country that they live in, that gives them more opportunity than anywhere else in the world. But they're being taught that by people that have a political agenda behind it. I think that is really dangerous for our democracy. I think that is really dangerous for our country. I am unabashedly pro-American. I wear pro-American gear. I will always say that I love America, while acknowledging that it has been at many times deeply imperfect. And this is something that we are trying to perfect. But it has to start with love and appreciation for the country. And I got that via military service. And I get that through engaging in the conversations and doing some of the work that I do now. And I think that if we don't start developing and instilling this in the next generation, and particularly in these colleges and universities, in these anti-American indoctrination centers that we call our colleges and universities, then we're going to be in trouble.
So you went to one of the great prestige universities, which is also a center of radicalism. How would you deal with them? What would you do with these institutions that are now so committed to an anti-American cult?
Look, defund them. Tell the people that are sending their money to these colleges and universities, stop sending your money to these places that are indoctrinating your kids into America-hating leftists. Second of all, start fighting to get conservative spots on the boards of trustees to these places. Start fighting to get more conservative-leaning professors on tenure track. Look, We've obviously lost these colleges and universities, and what has happened with them has been happening for decades, and we're just now catching up. This stuff has been seeping into these colleges and universities for the past 30, 40 years, just as it's been seeping into media and entertainment. So if people want to change that, number one, stop sending your money there. Number two, fight to get stronger positions on these boards of trustees. Number three, start fighting to get conservative-minded people to become professors and people of power in these universities. And number four, stop bowing and apologizing to these kids when they start stirring stuff up on campuses. Stop apologizing. You gotta stop apologizing to the mob. And I've said this so many times, the mob doesn't want apologies, they want your submission. And for too long, we have been submitting to these mobs on these college campuses. I'm a contributor with Turning Point USA, and I'm proud of the work that we do on these college campuses to just inject some kind of diversity of thought onto these campuses. And a lot of the times, Turning Point USA will be literally the only conservative or right-leaning organization on these campuses and standing up against 15 to 20 Democrat leftist liberal organizations. So people really have to start standing up against that. Stop sending them your money.
I don't have any idea, for example, how you would get selected to be on the board of governors, say for Columbia or Princeton, or I don't know to what extent it's automatically self-regulating and the insiders decide who gets to play.
I don't know either, but I think that we're starting to finally have the conversation about how damaging and pathetic some of these institutions are. Number two, trying to take some of that power back. So we're definitely 30 years too late, but these culture wars, and we talked a lot about, you know, my upcoming podcast, Rob Smith is Problematic, and even this book, Always a Soldier. This is about the culture wars. This is about free speech. This is about making sure that these universities and colleges are not liberal indoctrination centers, but they are places for people to explore, to grow, to be challenged, not just safe spaces, because these people are going to get a rude awakening when they get out into the real world, or they're going to go out into the real world, they're going to get into positions and in institutions like the New York Times, and they're going to radically tear down those institutions and change them into institutions that are not what they were originally intended to be.
You really have a big agenda ahead.
It's nothing that I can't handle. There's so many people that I look up to and so many people that are these new, young, sort of fresh voices of conservatism and Republican values. And I don't think that I'm doing it alone. I think that I'm certainly the only one that has my particular background and my particular experiences that are doing this. But it's a big fight. But Newt, America is worth it. America is worth it. It is worth the fight. It is worth standing up to the mob. It is worth losing friends and all that stuff. It's got to be something for the greater good. It's got to be for this country. And I would love to be looking back at this in 20 years and be one of the first figures that really said, look, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to believe in these conservative values and I'm going to try to promote them to other people. And I want to say that it doesn't matter what they look like or what their background is, what their sexual orientation is, or what their race or ethnicity or gender, any of these things. It's about beliefs and it's about ideology and it's about core values.
Do you find as you have these conversations, are you gradually winning people over, or is the whole larger pressure so intense that people just sort of feel like they can't take that big a jump?
What the left is really good at, they have the media, they have entertainment, they have institutions of power, they have social media. So we're fighting on social media. So the left is really good at suppressing voices like mine. So you never really know if you're truly breaking through. So the only way I know is if I look at the people that either buy my book or follow me on my social media platforms and say, you gave me my red pill, which means that you made me conservative, or you inspire me to start standing up in my college campus or to my family, or I'm a gay guy too, and these LGBTQ cultists on the left don't represent me. And when I look at you, I get inspired to do that. So you never really know until you start getting the messages. And I think that, Newt, the only way that you really know is if this stuff starts getting traction. When the podcast launches, if they're listening to the podcast, if they're buying Always a Soldier, if they're following me on social media, which they are. 2 years ago, I had an exec look at me to my face and say, you shouldn't do this because the conservatives aren't ready for that, or Republicans aren't ready for that, and it'll just be a massive failure. And if you really want to be more successful in media, what you need to do is just go be a local field reporter somewhere. Like, thank God that I thought more of the people of America than this executive did, because I knew that what he was saying wasn't true. And considering the fact that this was less than 2.5 years ago and all this stuff has happened, that proves that people are ready for the conversation. Now we just have to break through and make sure that the conversation happens in the most broad and large an audience as possible.
I'm fascinated because part of what I'm impressed by with you is that you really are doing a lot of different things. You have a book, you're on television, you're now launching a podcast. So you really have begun to find a rhythm that enables you to communicate with a lot of people.
Yeah. And honestly, just even you and I having this conversation, Newt, like, who would have thought that your company would get behind somebody like me 2.5 years ago? This is a part of what I'm talking about. This is a part of changing the conversation. I'm very excited about it because I'm very excited about getting sort of unfiltered views out. Because look, I do a lot of stuff on social media. I do a lot of quick reaction videos to the news of the day, and that's fine. You know, as well as I do, when you're doing a segment on Fox News, this is about what the news of the day is, and you've got 3 or 4 minutes to really make your point. And that's fine as well. That's a part of the field that we're in. But I'm excited about having more in-depth conversations about things that really matter. Maybe not so much the politics of the day all the time, but in things that people can use in their day-to-day life. And I think that we could do a better job at, as conservatives, as Republicans, is giving people things they can use in their day-to-day lives, giving people core values and say, look, discipline and self-reliance and personal responsibility and all these different things, they've worked for me and they can work for you too. That's what I'm excited about, just being able to have a more in-depth conversation.
Well, I just want to commend you. You communicate somehow, maybe this goes back to your Army training, you communicate a calm sense of confidence and being interesting without being hostile or aggressive. It's not an easy art form, as you know. Just take the last minute or so and tell folks, why should they get the book? What will they get out of the book? And where can they get the book?
Always a Soldier, Service, Sacrifice, and Coming Out as America's Favorite Black Gay Republican is going to be available wherever books are sold. I think that what you will get out of the book is a deeper examination, because it is about 70% Iraq War memoir and 30% political commentary. So first, you're going to really get into why I think and believe and act in the ways that I do. And when you will see some of the more hardscrabble stuff in my background, you will see why I joined the Army. You will see what I went through when I was in the Army. That will give you the foundation to understand more when I get into the politics, and when I talk about Trump and the black vote in 2020, and when I talk about coming out as conservative, when I talk about what I call the LGBTQ leftist cult. I think that it will give you not only a full, well-rounded sense of who I am, but also I think that because I do kind of have these identities that are so commonly associated with liberals, that there is an entryway, even if you are not a Republican, even if you don't agree with everything that's in the book, you will start understanding it a little bit more. And what we have to do as Americans, Newt, we have to start understanding each other and really listening to each other a little bit more. I'm proud of it. It's got a lot of fire. It's got a lot of character. I worked very hard in the memoir portion to do these men that I served with justice and to do their lives and their hopes and their dreams justice. Even when we clashed, even when we had conflict, I think that there are no heroes or there are no villains. There are only humans and Americans. And I think that that's what people can get out of it. Basically, how I came to love America and why I am fighting so hard to save it and what it needs to be saved from.
Let me just say that I think this has been a great introduction, and I hope the folks who listen to this will not only get your book, but I hope they will remember to start looking for your new podcast in about a month. And I think you're going to be really, really doing a great job, and you're doing a good job for the country. So I just want to thank you for taking this kind of time to share your ideas with us.
Absolutely. And as always, New, thank you and everybody else at Gingrich 360 for this opportunity. It's really massive. I'm very excited to move forward and to create some great stuff.
Thank you to my guest, Rob Smith. You can learn more about Rob and his new book, Always a Soldier, on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Sloan. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penman. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. Please email me with your questions at gingrich360.com/questions. I'll answer them in future episodes. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.